people who are so passionate about the gospel that on some questions, not a question like that, but on some questions about who is Jesus or who do you think he is, when the person gets it wrong, they are almost needing to be physically restrained. It's a Glasgow thing. It's just part of our friendly charm. You just want to go over and knock it into them. That is obviously not the way to lead a group. Now, the approach that I found very helpful is for the leader to understand that he or she is not the teacher. Get that into your mind. What is the teacher? Is the Bible. There's the Bible. ESV or NIV. It has to be NIV on Christianity Explored. We put the Bible into the middle of the group. And the job then of the leader is not to do all the teaching, not to give all the correct answers, not to say whether an answer is right or wrong, but is to say, thank you, Yvonne. Right, everybody, what do we think? Have a look at the passage again. Do you think that's what's going on there? Make sure that the Bible is the teacher and the job of the leader is continually to refer to the Bible. There are one or two questions where that won't be appropriate, when it's more reflective and you'll not find the Bible you'll not find the answer in the Bible. They're designed, and it always says it in the leader's guide. It always says this is designed to help the participants reflect. And for them, you're obviously going to be looking, you know, you're going to be listening to them and making sure, echoing their answers, making sure you've understood it properly. But in general, I think it's very helpful for leaders to say, right, as I go into this, I am not the teacher. The key thing here is not that they hear me, even if I'm giving right gospel orthodox answers. The key thing is that I lead them to the Bible. And we get the whole group. So Yvonne gives her answer. It pops back to the leader. He says, great, Yvonne, thank you very much for that. That's a clear answer. Yvonne, you're saying blah, 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 blah. What do we think about this? And what does the text say? Are we online with that? Can everybody see it? It also builds confidence. Here's, can never think of names. Here's Julie over here, who's very self-conscious, doesn't want to speak, but she suddenly finds that actually this isn't as bad as I think. I'm not being asked difficult theological questions. I'm just being asked to do basic interpretation that I learned in school. I'm just looking at a passage and finding the answers there. So making sure that the Bible is the teacher in the heart of the group and the leader is referring everything back to the text is, I think, an enormously helpful thing. So we're not just batting questions out, getting answers back and working through and involving everybody so that all five people have answered a question and we move on. We're actually trying to get discussion. And as you grow in confidence, then you find yourself bowling the odd googly in and saying, well, do you think that's right? What do you think is going on here? And just opening it up and getting people to really begin to engage with the text. It's a phenomenal skill for them to learn, and it will stand them in good stead. Now, as we go to the DVD, let me just show you this. On page 12, there is a talk outline that is prepared. This is the point in the evening or the afternoon or the lunch hour when we say, now, we're not going to take your questions at the moment. We're just going to listen either to the live talk or we're going to watch the DVD. And if you're doing this one-to-one, what I found fantastically helpful was we just had a coffee together. We talked about things. We had a quick chat through group discussion one, and then we said, well, let's watch the DVD, this week's DVD. It's just like a documentary program. Everybody is used to dealing with that. And even in the office, you could probably find a laptop to watch it on, or you can, in the comfort of your home, you can stick it on, sit with someone, and you've got Rico in the front room. 42 inches on the broad screen of Rico, which is fantastic. I think Rico's the only person who can't use the DVD in one-to-one. And he's probably the only person in the world who can't use it because it's his face that's on it. He has to do it one-to-one. So as we look at the DVD, be thinking about how you could use that as a tool for one-to-one evangelism as well as a way of using it on Christianity Explored. So week 3 DVD, let's have a look at it just now. Thank you very much.
In 1991, when I went to theological college, I immediately joined the university rugby club, which was quite competitive. So I was sent a summer training schedule. In it were details of club training and testing. And I was to report here to Iffley Road at 10 o'clock in the morning with my gear. So I circled the date in my calendar and filed the training schedule in the bin. I thought to myself, I'll do some press-ups, do some sit-ups, go on some runs, I'll be fine. Well, September eventually rolled around, I had a pretty casual summer, and I turned up here with my gear, feeling quietly confident. When I arrived, all the guys were very quiet. There was an eerie silence in the changing room, no banter at all. Then suddenly the coach came in and said, right, we'll start with a bleep test. The bleep test is a test where you run back and forth over 20 yards in time with a bleep that gets faster and faster. You run until you drop. In my case, that was not long in coming. I was the second to drop out, having collapsed and been physically sick. Next, we had to strip off to our shorts for the so-called fat tests. I think we'll leave this part of my story to the imagination, but suffice it to say, it wasn't pretty. Your body fat is measured by this contraption that pinches the flesh on your bicep, tricep, stomach, side, thigh and calf. There was only one other guy who had a higher percentage of body fat than me. We became firm friends. Well, flabby friends anyway. The results of all these tests were recorded and publicly announced. It was extremely humiliating. Eventually, when all the tests had been completed, the coach got all of us together and said, well, it's not comfortable, but at least we found out the truth on the training ground before the real questions get asked during a proper game. Some of you have been really exposed, haven't you? Sometimes we experience things in life that give us a shocking dose of reality, that expose us in an extremely uncomfortable way. But as our coach said, it's better to find out the truth about ourselves while we still have time to do something about it. We've already explored Jesus' power and authority. The question now is, why did Jesus come? Did he want to bring peace on earth? That's the Jesus of Christmas carols. Was it to heal disease and end the sufferings of the world? That's Jesus the great healer. Or did he want to change society through his teaching? That's Jesus the great teacher. Although there's an element of truth in all of those options, Mark's gospel doesn't give any of them as Jesus' main aim. If we look at the world, there's lots to marvel at. But who can honestly say that the world is all good? There's so much wrong with it. A history of the 20th century will tell you that 100 million people died violently in those 100 years. That is 2,400 violent deaths a day. Suicide rates are increasing all the time. More marriages than ever end in divorce. And more of us are subject to violent crime in our lives. But you probably don't need me to tell you all that. It's in the newspapers every day. The question is, why is the world like this? Jesus tells us the uncomfortable truth in Mark's gospel. He insists that the reason there is something wrong with the world is because there's something wrong with us. Imagine for a moment a large public gallery. As time goes by, this gallery will gradually fill up with the story of your life. Eventually, it will be a complete and truthful account, not only of everything you've ever said and done, but also of everything you've ever thought. Nothing is edited out. Everything is here for anyone to look at. Every day is here on the walls. 5th of September, 1989. 4th of November, 1996. 24th of May, 2002. It's a complete record of your life. Now, I'm sure there'd be lots to celebrate here. Loving relationships, real achievements, acts of kindness, moments of generosity and selflessness, perhaps a flourishing career. But there would also be thousands of things that you'd want to keep out of the public gaze. Which bit of the wall would you most want to cover up? Maybe it's something that nobody knows, not even your closest friend. And it's not just the things we've said, done and thought that are a problem. There are the things we should have done and the people we should have helped. If my life was on those walls, it would be a nightmare. I'd hate my life to be on display for everyone to see. I'd be so ashamed. I wouldn't be able to look people in the eye. Could you, if you're being honest? So what is the problem? Why is there so much to be ashamed of? Jesus gives us the answer in Mark chapter 7, verses 20 to 23. What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. So when we look at the world and see all the things that are wrong with it, we instinctively want to point the finger at others. But Jesus says the problem is much closer to home. The reason the world is not the way it's supposed to be is because we are not the way we're supposed to be. And if we were to trace all the evil in the world back to its source, says Jesus, the place we'd end up is the human heart. To the people of Jesus' day, the heart was not just the pump that sent blood around our veins. It was the seat of human personality, the inner you, the real you. Why is it so hard to keep good relationships going? Why do we hurt those we love most? Why can't we automatically do what we know is the right thing? Because each of us has a heart problem. Unfortunately, according to Jesus, our problems don't end there. It's not just the fact that we often treat each other and our world in a shameful way. We also treat God in that way too. In Mark chapter 12, verse 30, Jesus tells us how we should treat God. He says, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength." Since God made us and sustains us and gives us every good thing we enjoy, and since he has power and authority over our lives, what should be our response to him? Jesus tells us our response should be to love him. And the really scary word here is all. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So no part of our lives is to be withheld from God. He is to have all of everything. But actually, he's had all of nothing. We decide exactly what we'll do with our heart, soul, mind and strength. We give our hearts to lots of things, but not our Creator. We don't even know his commands, let alone seek to obey them. We develop relationships with others, but neglect the very relationship for which we were primarily designed. And instead of loving God, we live as if we were God. And that's what the Bible calls sin. So why did Jesus come? According to Mark's gospel, Jesus came to rescue us from our sin. Here's what happens in Mark chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Did you notice how uptight the religious authorities were with Jesus? These people, called the Pharisees and teachers of the law, were the religious establishment. They were always at the synagogue, always praying, always doing the right thing. And they are furious here because Jesus is hanging out with all the people they love to look down on, particularly this chap who was a tax collector. Now, tax collectors were even more hated than they are today. They were universally reviled as traitors because they were working for the occupying Roman forces. But the shock for us, as indeed it was for the religious establishment of the time, is Jesus' statement in verse 17. "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners." You see, Jesus knows that when we look at our world and the state of our hearts, no one can seriously claim to be righteous. No one has managed to love God with all their heart, all their soul, all their mind, and all their strength. If we were able to live like that, there'd be no reason for him to have come at all. No, says Jesus, I haven't come to call people who think they're good, who think that they have nothing to be ashamed of. If they think they're okay without me, then obviously they're going to reject me. Instead, he says, I've come for people who are able to look honestly at their own failings and know that they need rescuing. For those people, Jesus is the best news in the world because he's come to rescue them. So the qualification for coming to Jesus is not, are you good enough? It's, are you bad enough? He's come for sinners, not for people who think they're righteous. That's the real reason Jesus came. And isn't it ironic that these religious people, who think that their hearts are perfectly acceptable to God, are the very ones who end up plotting to kill Jesus? So Jesus says, I have not come to call the righteous but sinners. But why did Jesus feel the need to call sinners at all? For the answer to that question, we need to look at the harshest verses in Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, verses 43 to 47. It's here that Jesus tells us exactly how serious our sin really is. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life maimed than with two hands to go into hell, where the fire never goes out. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life crippled than to have 2 feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have 2 eyes and be thrown into hell. I was in Australia staying with a friend, and he took me to a beach on Botany Bay. It was empty, the sun was out, and the water was crystal clear and as calm as a mill pond. So I decided I had to go for a swim. I was just taking my shirt off when my host said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going for a swim." He said, "But what about those signs?" I looked round and there were some huge signs which read, "Danger, sharks, no swimming." I said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous, I'll be fine." He looked at me and said, "Listen, mate, 200 Australians have been killed by sharks over the years. You have to work out whether those signs are there to save you or to ruin your fun. You're of age, you decide." And with that, he walked off. Well, I just sat there and rather sheepishly put my clothes back on. Now, clearly my accent is absolutely appalling, but I hope you see the point. Jesus' words are like a huge danger sign for us. We're free to decide whether to ignore them or not, but he warns us for a reason. Jesus warns us that our sin will lead us to hell. If we reject God throughout our lives, then ultimately he will respect that decision and reject us. Believe me, I take no pleasure in relating these words of Christ. Just as God takes no pleasure in allowing people to go their own self-destructive way. I hope you can see that the reason Jesus warns us about hell is because he loves us and does not want us to go there. He says we should do anything to avoid it. If our hand causes us to rebel, we should cut it off. If it's our eye, we should pluck it out. Hell is real and we should do anything to avoid it. But here's our predicament. What's our biggest problem? Is it the hand or the eye? No, as we've seen, the real problem is our heart. If it was the eye or the foot or the hand, we could sort that out. But we can't cut out our heart. So we're in dire need of rescue. That, above all else, is why Jesus came. Remember my rugby training? As much as I hated the fat tests and the bleep tests, it was far better for me to be exposed as unfit on the training ground than in front of spectators in a key game. In the same way, Jesus exposes what we're really like so that we can accept his rescue while there's still time. But we'll never understand why Jesus came unless we come to grips with the fact that we have not treated God as we should. And if we don't understand that, then we'll go through life without noticing that actually we are in terrible danger.
Well, I wonder if you can imagine sitting with a friend, having done a little group study in Mark's Gospel, having watched that together, the humor of it, but very, very hard-hitting, strong in implication Bible teaching. And that is the talk or the DVD segment of what we do on Christianity Explored. But you could use that as a one-to-one tool very effectively. We then go into the group discussion too, and I'd like just to give you 5 minutes on that as we go to lunch. Have a glance across at it. The idea of group discussion too is not to do a Bible study, but is to tease out the implications for the people that we're working with. What does it mean to them? So do you agree that you're in danger? How would you feel if every word and thought and action were displayed in the walls for everyone to see? And how do you react to the words of Jesus in Mark chapter 9. Now, I know that you're Christian people, you know the answers to these things, but just in your groups, again, you could be talking just for 5 minutes about how your non-Christian friends would respond to that and get the feel for what that's going to be like and think about the fact that this is how we, these are the questions we ask in one-to-one work or in group work in order to make the gospel crystal clear. So take 5 minutes on that and then we're going to go to lunch. Thank you.
Just as we're in that, just on the table group, here's the question that will be thrown in. Let's just wrestle with this one here. Someone on the table just says, I loved my mother very much. She passed away 5 years ago. I think of her every day. And she was nowhere spiritually. She was just lovely. So what are you saying about my mother? Okay, how would you handle that? You're a table leader. They've just thrown that out. Okay, everybody. It's 2:15, so we've got to stop for lunch. Just to say, everyone, the reason we run week three is because this is the missionary moment on the course. When we get feedback about the course, as you can imagine, if people get the seriousness of sin in week three, then they're going to be fleeing to the cross. They're going to be marveling at grace if they harden their hearts and walk. So it's the missionary moment. I often used to think, obviously, whether they understand grace or not is whether we win or lose or not. But actually, whether they see the wonder of grace is this week, week three. So crucial week. We always say in terms of food, you know, give them a couple of cream crackers week five on grace. When it's week three, do lobster. Give them something, you know, do the. But it's a tougher week. Craig, just on that question. So you're on the table group. Someone, you know, tearfully has just said, what are you saying about a loved one, about my mother? What would you be wanting to say on that?
I think it just goes back to first principles on that. The first thing you would want to do is take a moment to acknowledge the loss and take a moment just to reflect on it in the group. When did your mum die and what were the circumstances? And don't just batter on to the answer. Hear the person and make sure that they know you've heard them. Reflect to them. But then in terms of the answer to the question, it's back to the two great issues that we've looked at this morning, the sovereignty of God and integrity of the gospel. We cannot give an answer that goes beyond what we know to be true. We cannot give any false assurances about that. So we have to say we believe that God is just and that the judge of all the earth will do right. We have to leave your mum in his hands. We have to leave your loved one with him. We can't make any clear decision. We can't speak for God on that issue. But remembering the sovereignty of God.
Great. Just let me just pick that up. So in other words, I do not say, well, your mother's in hell.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely not. Nor to say, well, I think God's very gracious. I think she might be in heaven. I mean, the moment is longing for us to do that. You know, everything in us wants to say, it's only week three. If I get this wrong, they're not going to come back. But gospel integrity means we trust God's sovereignty. Yeah. So, Lord, I'm going to say something now that is true, and I'm trusting you to help the person absorb this truth, and that they'll go away saying, well, these guys are people of integrity. They're not telling me necessarily what I want to hear. They're telling me the facts. And, you know, God's grace has a way of cushioning people from these realities. It's quite remarkable. So I think we say that, and then inwardly you're thinking, well, God is the one who opens blinded eyes. And what I always think about someone who presents with an issue like that is that the past is holding them in prison spiritually. The fact that they've had a death in the family, it might have been a husband, a wife, a child, a sibling, parent, someone who's passed away, they don't know where they are, is holding them. I've had people say to me, to be honest, I don't want to go to heaven if my family's not there. Now, that's Satan's blinding lie. And in that moment, we don't have all the time and all the skill and all the energy to unpick all that. But what we have to do is trust in God's sovereignty and say to the person, now look, we're hearing what you're saying in that. I'm giving you an answer. We have to trust God for where your loved one is. But you are on this course. And if your mum's life and death means a lot to you and you want to learn anything from it, your journey has brought you here. And you mustn't allow the uncertainty of that to cause you to be uncertain about where you stand in relation to these things. You don't want your family in 40 years' time saying, my dad lived and died and I don't know what he believed and I don't know what he thought. So we're saying to the person, you need to be decisive about the information you're being given and not be frozen out of that by the experience of the uncertainty of the past. Does that make
sense?
Yeah,
I think absolutely. And it may be that the 9 o'clock slot, which is more one-to-one, is when I pick that up. So at the time, I want to hear what happened. I want to say, look, you know, this person is in God's hands. I'm not the judge. But the Bible says some serious things. Can we hear them? But I'm not the judge. I don't know where they went. It's Christ who is the judge. But what I do want to do is the one-to-one, I want to pick that up at 9 o'clock. So 9 o'clock, 9:10, I want to explore, explain, encourage. So I might want to say to them, listen, please don't allow this to lock you in.
Yeah.
This can lock you in and stop you moving forward. So just bear that in mind. I'm sure there are questions arising from that. I'm sure you've got them on the table. There will be time for questions at 4 o'clock. So Craig and I will be around at lunch. Let's pray as we go to lunch. Let me pray.